For this edition of The Spotlight, from Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury, they shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President Raisi welcomes Venezuela's President Maduro at an official ceremony in Tehran. Ukraine's military says it urgently needs Western weaponry to ward off Russian attacks in the east. Also coming up in this newscast, U.S. stocks taking a nosedive after inflation accelerates to a 40-year high. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has been officially welcomed by his Iranian counterpart Ebrahim Raisi here in Tehran. Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran on Friday on a two-day state visit. He is due to sit down with a number of senior Iranian officials. Hours after his arrival, Maduro spoke with Iran's Spanish-language news network, Hispan TV. He told the channel that Tehran and Caracas would sign a roadmap for 20-year bilateral cooperation. Maduro added that the conclusion of the document would usher in a new era of relations between the two countries. Iran and Venezuela have in recent years expanded their ties in different fields, including politics and economy. Our correspondent has asked the Venezuelan president about his thoughts on the significance of alternative media such as Press TV, Telesur, to break the monopoly of Western media. Here's what he said.
Well, first of all, the truth of the peoples opens up all paths. It's like turning on a light in the dark. The truth of the peoples is the light we need. Also, making a grand technological endeavor, a very professional one, for the highest quality of information, so that anyone in the world, wherever they are, can access the alternative media that have begun to emerge in the world through their phone, tablets, computer, or television.
Author and journalist Arnold August joined us earlier to explain why the Venezuelan president's visit to Iran is significant.
During the height of the American sanctions against Venezuela, the Iranian government courageously sent several tankers over a period of 1 or 2 years in order to assist the Venezuelan oil industry to kickstart itself. So this is just what is happening today, is a continuation of this extremely important bilateral relations between Venezuela and Iran. I think it has, you know, there's a lot of important points. I cannot just today regarding this summit in the of the Americas. Daniel Ortega, representing the Nicaragua government, said in his country what many people perhaps were thinking but not say out aloud, as he did. And he said one of the reasons that Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua were excluded from the summit by the United States was as a result of these three countries, their close ties with Russia in the current situation. I guess indirectly it's also because of how these three countries together are working in order to try to push against U.S. hegemony in this very important period of world history.
Iran is calling for an immediate and effective action by the international community to end the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. on the country. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says the coercive measures have negatively affected the country's health system. Zahra Ershadi told a meeting of the UN General Assembly on AIDS that the sanctions have seriously violated Iran's rights to access health care, especially for those who are suffering from AIDS. Ershadi said the unilateral measures have hindered patients' timely and effective access to medicine and medical equipment. The U.S. reimposes unilateral sanctions on Iran in 2018. The measures block Iran's access to financial channels, effectively preventing the country from making any payment for purchased goods. Iran condemns the latest Israeli missile strike on the Syrian capital, Damascus, vowing to stand by the country's government and people. Iran's foreign minister says the Israeli attacks against Syrian infrastructure are illegal under international law and violate its sovereignty. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also says the regional and international silence on the attacks are shameful. He made the comments in a phone call with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal Maqdad. Also, he said that Israel's hasty acts of aggression are a sign of its fear and weakness. Maqdad said the regime is vainly trying to prop up remnants of the terrorist groups in Syria. The latest Israeli airstrike early on Friday caused heavy damage to airstrips at the Damascus International Airport. Our flights are currently suspended. Syria says civil aviation personnel are working to fix the problem and restore the flights. For the second day in a row, members of the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq organization have tried to sabotage an exhibition in the Swedish capital displaying their crimes. Bianca Rahimi was there.
Members of the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist group, also known as the MKO, gathered in the Swedish capital on Friday for the second day in a row to sabotage an exhibition on the group's crimes. The Swedish police struggled to control the situation, with MKO members spreading out, running down the streets away from the place designated for the protest and harassing Press TV's reporters and camera crew. On Thursday, several members of the MKO were arrested for attacking the exhibition and throwing objects, including paint, at the exhibition and public property. The organiser of the expo, the Harbilion NGO, say the police tried to sabotage the event by refusing to allow banners to be put up and denying journalists adequate security, despite them having the necessary permits. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Its members fled Iran in 1986 to Iraq, where they enjoyed backing from former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. MKO terrorists enjoy freedom of activity and movement in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches. The organizers of this event say that the MKO has protested in the Swedish capital for 90 days straight with government security. This suggests that this organization feels safe and protected here in Sweden. Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Ukraine asking the West for more weapons as Russia steps up attacks in the east more than 3 months into the war there. Ukrainian military officials say they are outgunned by the more powerful Russian army. They say they need more advanced Western weapons, including rocket systems, to fend off Russian artillery attacks. Moscow has been focusing its firepower in the eastern Donbass region over the past few weeks, with the fiercest battles taking place in the Severodonetsk, in an industrial city of Luhansk province. Ukrainians have largely pulled out of the city's residential areas, but they are still putting up resistance against Russian advance from the north and the south. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is actually trying to break every town in Donbass. And now, as the fighting continues in Ukraine, especially in the eastern parts of the country, Johnny Miller reports on how schools are being targeted by the Ukrainian army.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens, and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximise casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The fallout of the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take heavy tolls on the U.S. economy. U.S. stocks fall sharply as the country's inflation surges to a new four-decade high record. The New York Stock Exchange saw Dow Jones Industrial Average, the broad-based S&P 500, and the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index all tumble. It came after the Labor Department said the Consumer Price Index surged by 8.6% in May compared to the same period last year, which is unseen since 1981. This figure exceeded all forecasts. This comes as gasoline prices are hitting records every day in the U.S. as the war in Ukraine drags on. Prices are continue to rise last month for a range of other goods, including housing, groceries, and airline fares, as well as other vehicles. The U.S. and China ramp up a war of words over Taiwan, a self-ruled island that China considers as part of its territory. The Pentagon chief has accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. Lloyd Austin has told a security summit in Singapore that there is growing coercion from Beijing. On Friday, Chinese Defense Minister Wei Fenghe said that his country would not hesitate to start a war if Taiwan declares independence. The same day, the two officials met on the sidelines of the summit to discuss global, regional, and bilateral security issues. Their talks largely focused on Taiwan. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taipei. Recently, President Joe Biden also angered China after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if attacked. Iranians have gathered in Tehran to mark the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth infallible imam of the Shia household. Iranians seized the opportunity to condemn France for awarding a movie which insulted Imam Reza during the Cannes Film Festival almost 10 days ago. Salman Kujuri reports.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth infallible Shia imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by global arrogance.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away. So the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever, and the enemy's plots will never bear any results.
I believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider has been totally politically motivated, and it was an open insult to Islamic sanctities. We condemn such a movie, and we condemn such a sacrilegious act against Islam.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Glimpses of Imam Reza's dynamic life. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations on a very auspicious day, in whose blessings Iran and the faithful all over the world are basking. As you know, today is the 11th of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, the day on which, in the year 148 AH, corresponding to 766 AD, Imam Reza, peace upon him, was born in Medina, the city of his illustrious ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He was the Prophet's 18th fallible heir
And during his 20-year period of imamat, he ably guided the seekers of truth to the shores of salvation, despite the harassment to which he was subjected by three tyrannical Abbasid caliphs, the last of whom, Ma'mun, forcibly brought him to Marvin Khorasan and against his will declared him the heir apparent of the Islamic realm in order to mislead the Muslim masses into thinking that the ruler was respecting the Immaculate Ahl al-Bayt and then had him secretly martyred through a dose of poison. Stay with us for a special feature on the life and times of Imam Reza, peace upon him, whose holy shrine in Mashhad is the most sacred spot on the soil of Iran. But before that, we recite to you Ayah 36 of Surah Nur, which reads, "In houses Allah has allowed to be raised and wherein His name is celebrated, He is glorified therein morning and evening." When this ayah was revealed by God through Archangel Gabriel, the Prophet expounded its meaning to his companions. According to a narration found in the books of Hadith of our Sunni brethren, Abu Bakr asked whether the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon them, was also among the houses exalted by Allah. The Messenger of Mercy replied in affirmation and added that it is the best of houses. Alas, today the godless Wahhabis have destroyed not just the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima, peace upon them, along with the entire Bani Hashim locality in Medina, but their blasphemous bulldozers have left no trace of the house where the Prophet of Islam, whom God calls Mercy unto the entire creation, was born in Mecca. The question that arises is that by such ungodly acts that are not less in profanity than the periodical sacrilege to which some satanic minds in the West resort against the sanctities of Islam through films, journals, and novels, have the Wahhabis succeeded in obliterating from Muslim minds the hallowed status of the Prophet's Ahl al-Bayt, whose spotless purity God Almighty Himself has vouched in the Noble Quran in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab? The answer is a big no. The facts are all too obvious. A house is not just a place where a person is born and lives, but also the final resting place, or, in other words, the grave which houses his or her body. To be more precise, the ayah of Surah Nur that we recited includes, without the least doubt, the holy shrines of the Ahl al-Bayt, where day and night the name of God Almighty is glorified, and which are indeed the most exalted abodes anywhere in the world. One such hallowed house is in Iran, in the city of Mashhad, which is now hosting millions of Muslims from not just all over the Islamic Republic, but from different parts of the globe. It is the shrine of the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who was, as we said earlier, born on the 11th of Dhul-Qa'dah in the year 148 AH, in his now destroyed house in Medina, but who through immortal martyrdom found a permanent place in Khorasan that leads the believers to the celestial heavens. Imam Reza, peace upon him, needs no introduction. His father was Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, who rests in peace in Kazemain near Baghdad, where he was martyred through poisoning by the tyrant Harun al-Rashid. His grandfather, as Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the reviver of the Prophet's pristine practice and behavior, Sunnah and Sirah, which is known today all over the world as Fiqhul Ja'fariya. The eighth Imam's mother was the virtuous lady from North Africa, Toktam, also called Najm-e Khatun. In 183 AH, the divine mantle of Imamat came to rest on the shoulders of Imam Reza, peace upon him, who ably discharged the duties entrusted to him by God Almighty in guiding the people. He himself was a paragon of virtues and ethics, without the slightest blemish in his impeccable character. As mentioned by the famous narrator of the hadith, the Iranian scholar Sheikh Muhammad ibn Babwei Saduq, who lived over a millennium ago, in the words of Ibrahim ibn Abbas, "I never saw Ali Reza committing excess over anyone in talking and interrupting anybody's speech before its coming to the end. He did not stretch his legs in the presence of others. When the meal table was laid, he invited the servants to it and took his meals with them. After taking rest in the nights, he got up and made himself busy with the prayers to Allah. Similar to his forefathers, he carried food to the houses of the afflicted ones at the mid of nights." These flawless traits are an indication of not just the unsullied personalities of the Ahlul Bayt, but indicate the infallibility of their immaculate ancestor, the Prophet of Islam, the exemplar par excellence for all mankind, as God calls him in the Noble Quran. Imam Reza, peace upon him, who was kind to everyone, did not tolerate any deviation, even if the person who committed wrong was to be his relative or brother, as is clear by an admonition from the eighth Imam to his erring brother Zayd, which shows it is virtue that exalts a person in the sight of God. One day, when Imam Reza was delivering a speech in a grand assembly, he heard Zayd praising himself before the people, saying, "I am so and so." Imam Reza asked him, "O Zayd, have you trusted the words of the grocers of Kufa and are conveying them to the people? What kind of things are you talking about? The sons of Ali ibn Abi Talib and Fatima Zahra are worthy and outstanding only when they obey the commandments of Allah and keep themselves away from sin and blunder. You think you are like Imam Musa Kazem, Imam Ali ibn Hussein, and other Imams? Whereas they took pains and bore hardships on the way to Allah and prayed to Allah day and night. Do you think you will gain without pain? Beware that if a person of us, the Ahlul Bayt, performs a good deed, he gets twice the reward, because not only he performed good deeds like others, but also that he has maintained the honor of Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. If he practices something bad and does a sin, he has performed two sins. One is that he performed a bad act like the rest of the people, and the other one is that he has negated the honor of Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O brother, the one who obeys Allah is from us, the Ahl al-Bayt, and the one who is a sinner is not ours. Allah said about the son of Noah, who cut the spiritual bondage with his father, he is not out of your lineage, but he was your lineage. I would have saved him from the deluge and granted him salvation. In 201 AH, Imam Reza, peace upon him, was forcibly brought to the city of Marv in Khorasan by Ma'mun, who was afraid of the popularity among the Muslim Ummah of the Prophet's heir. In order to deceive the people, Ma'mun outwardly showed respect to Imam Reza, peace upon him, and offered him the caliphate, an offer which the Imam politely refused with the words, "If the caliphate is really yours, you owe not to give to others what God has given you as a trust. And if it does not belong to you, how can you give to others what is not yours?" The crafty caliph was stupefied but threatened the imam that he had no other option and should agree to become his heir apparent, although Imam Reza, peace upon him, was some 20 years older than Ma'mun. To celebrate the occasion, but actually to deceive the public, the caliph had poets sing praises of the imam and had their hands and even mouths stuffed with pearls and jewels from the public treasury, the looted wealth of the Muslim people. The black insignia of the Abbasids was replaced by the green insignia of the Alawites, or the descendants of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. And to give the impression of the seriousness to these theatrics, coins were struck proclaiming the Prophet's 18th infallible heir as heir apparent to the Abbasid usurper, whose great-grandfathers Mansur Dawaniqi and Abul Abbas Safah had 7 years ago hijacked the caliphate on the slogan of returning the rule of Islamic realm to the Ahl al-Bayt from the godless Umayyads. Soon, to his horror, Ma'mun realized that, through such theatrics, he had failed to isolate the imam from the ummah, as the popularity of the Prophet's rightful successor grew every day amongst the people. In view of his exemplary lifestyle, his God-given knowledge and wisdom, and his dynamic debates with the leaders and scholars of various schools of thought and religion, Ma'mun then invited leaders of various religions and schools of thought and asked Imam Reza, peace upon him, to debate with them, in the hope that these scholars of Jews, Sabians, Zoroastrians, Christians, Hindus, and atheists would outwit the Prophet's successor. For instance, when Imran as-Sabi asked Imam Reza, peace upon him, "Do we declare the oneness of God by reality or by description?" the imam answered, "Certainly, God, the light, the initiator of this cosmos, and the foremost, is one without any associate or any accompanying thing. He is unique without a second. The initiator has been self-existent, and the light that is dispending with everything. He did not exist in a definite time and will not last for a definite time. He has not existed in anything, has not hidden himself in anything. No sayer can invent a statement describing him, even if he thinks of light, example, apparition or shadow. And that was before the creation and in the situation where there was nothing but him. The same situation is in this position. There are only imaginary attributes and a translation of a picture in the mind purposed for making others understand. Did you understand, Imran? Imran Sabi, who lacked proper cognition of God, the one and only, had no other choice but to admit the truth of Islam. After this lively discourse on the Almighty Creator, of which we have only presented excerpts. Imam Reza, peace upon him, held similar debates with Jewish and Christian scholars and proved to them the truth and righteousness of Islam. For instance, during the debate with the Jewish scholar Ras al-Jalut, the Imam asked him about the prophethood of Moses, peace upon him. In reply, the Jewish scholar cited the miraculous parting of the sea waters and the turning of the staff into a giant snake. Imam Reza, peace upon him, said, "So you believe in Moses since he did what others could not do? Therefore, whoever claims prophethood and then does something which others are not able to do, you would believe him?" Ras al-Jalut replied, "No. I believe in Moses because he has a high status in the sight of God, and we cannot believe whoever claims to be prophet unless he brings miracles such as those of Moses." Imam Reza, peace upon him, said, "Then how do you believe in the prophets before Moses, whereas they could not bring miracles such as those of Moses?" The Jewish scholar replied, "I said that I believe those who perform some miracles for proving their prophethood." Imam Reza, peace upon him, said, "Why do you not have faith in Jesus? Did he not revive the dead and heal the blind, leprous and mad, and build beds from clay and made them alive on the command of God?" The Jewish scholar replied, "It is said that he did these, but we did not see them." Imam Reza, peace upon him, then said, "Have you seen the miracles of Prophet Moses, or have you just heard them from reliable persons?" The Jewish scholar acknowledged the words of the Imam, who then went on to say that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the last and greatest messenger of God, was an orphan and worked as a shepherd, but it was God who gave him the eternal miracle of the noble Quran, which will remain forever, while the miracles performed by the other prophets, including Moses, were time-bound. The Imam thus proved that the miracle of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, that is the Noble Quran, is eternal and alive, and can be seen and acknowledged by all, while the miracles of the past prophets are events of the past. We once again congratulate our listeners and end our special feature with a wonderful saying from Imam Reza, peace upon him, which is indeed food for thought. As for the brain, it is the greatest of all Allah's creatures. It dominates the whole body, controls all movements of it, and drives it to wherever it desires. And by it, man is distinguished from the rest of animals. Allah has singled out the brain for man, and through it, He has ennobled man over all His creatures. Surely, the brain is a world of wonders. No creature can match it in greatness, for it contains stores which never are full, and it preserves whatever knowledge is deposited in it. If we want to mention the wonders of the brain, then we have to write a full book about them. Glory belongs to Him who has originated and created the brain.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Operation Cyanide, Part 2.
Operation Cyanide. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. All the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Forty-five minutes later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines. The next target for Israeli fighter jets was Syria. 2 hours later, the Syrian Air Force was totally destroyed. And in only a few minutes, Jordan's Air Force had been dealt a heavy blow by Israeli fighters. This extraordinary surprise attack could not have been carried out without detailed intelligence superiority. On the Sinai Desert, where Egyptian and Israeli armored units had lined up against each other, the Egyptians had the upper hand in military force. Egypt had three times the number of tanks that the Israelis did, but there was no air cover to keep the Sinai sky safe for the Egyptians. Egyptians had no option but to retreat. The orders to retreat in the Sinai Desert came from the office of General Abdul Hakim Amer, the Egyptian war minister. But there was no plan for it. The unplanned retreat of the Egyptians began, and the Israeli fighter jets used the opportunity the best they could and devastated the Egyptians. When the USSR realized that in a matter of hours, the balance of military power in the war in the Middle East had switched dramatically in favor of Israel, it gave 48 of its MiG fighter jets to fly from Ukraine to Armenia's naval base to prepare for an attack against Israel. On the other hand, the Kremlin activated the hotline between the U.S. and the USSR so that Kosygin's ultimatum could be delivered to Washington. The text contained the message that since the U.S. is Israel's supporter, we ask you to stop the continuation of Israel's aggression against Egyptian soil.
About 7:15, the telephone rang. It was the duty officer in the war room. Mr. Secretary, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. He wishes to speak to the president. Well, the president came on the line. He said, in effect, goddammit, Bob, what are you calling me for at this time in the morning? I said, Mr. President, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. How do you wish to respond?
Johnson didn't want the situation to turn into a military confrontation with the USSR. He immediately sent word to Moscow that with the help of the USSR and the UN, the U.S. will use any means to put an end to the war. The first day of war was nearing midday when, in a televised speech, Eshkol and King Hussein and the rest of the Arabs.
We appeal to King Hussein and to other neighbors to stay their hands. And Israel would do likewise.
But King Hussein didn't take the advice so seriously. Therefore, at 10:30 in the morning of the 5th of June, Al-Quds came under the attack of Jordan's artillery forces. But the Jordanians weren't able to do anything either, and the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which they had control of before the war, fell to the Israelis. The Six-Day War was in its third day as the main battle was taking place somewhere far from where the Arabs and Israelis were fighting, in the depths of the Mediterranean waters. The U.S. was unhappy about the USSR's dominance over the Middle East. To confront communism from spreading any more in the region, it was trying very hard to uncover the details of the relations the USSR had with Arabs in the Middle East. This motivated them to quietly snoop around the intelligence cables of Cairo and Moscow. But because it didn't want the issue to be revealed so that no one would find out about it, everyone else had to be busy dealing with another crisis. The third day of the war was reaching the evening when the Liberty reached the international waters in the north of Egypt and Israel, and it transmitted the initial news of Israel's victories and the conquest of the old city of Al-Quds to the NSA. But the question, which had kept the officers on board the Liberty busy, was why an unarmed military ship should be present in the vicinity of a conflict zone without an armed escort and be left all alone. The commander of the Liberty, Captain William McGonagall, asked this question from the commander of the U.S. Navy's 6th Fleet, which had retreated 100 miles from the region.
We were told there was no need to worry. We had asked Commander 6th Fleet for an armed guard to go along with us, a destroyer. He sent the message back saying we were in international waters, flying the American ensign. There was no need for an armed escort.
When Egypt and Jordan were removed from Israel's path, it was time for the Golan Heights on the border between Israel and Syria to come under the watchful eyes of the Israelis. 12 hours later, and with heavy fire of fighter jets and artillery forces, not only did the Syrians retreat from Israel's borders, but the Golan Heights were also occupied by the Israelis. A few kilometers away from the war zone, on the fourth day of the battle, the officers and crew of the Liberty had just woken up and were busy with their morning activities. A while later, several unknown planes got closer to the ship and encircled it many times to completely identify the ship. The planes didn't display any flags on their bodies, and the Liberty's crew wasn't able to identify which country they belonged to. But the recorded conversation of the pilot and watchtower shows that the planes had identified the Liberty well. A few hours later, when it was a few minutes past 2 p.m., three Mirage jets, which still didn't have the insignia of any country, got close to the Liberty and bombed the ship as much as they could with their rockets. But the main question was which side of the war may have attacked the Liberty, Egypt or Israel?